For the broadcast this evening, we're going to talk about, first of all, a recent article in The Nation magazine talking about George Bush's involvement not only with the CIA, but his possible involvement with the aftermath of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We're then going to take a look at George Bush's connections to another assassination, or would-be assassination, namely the shooting of President Reagan in 1981. We're going to take a look not only at John W. Hinckley Sr.'s participation in an organization called World Vision, we're going to take a look at John W. Hinckley Jr.'s participation in the American Nazi Party, from which he was expelled because they thought he was a federal agent and too violent. We'll also take a look at how John Hinckley was able to stalk Jimmy Carter with weapons and ammunition with impunity in October of 1980, a few months before he allegedly shot President Reagan. We're going to take a look at more of John Hinckley's Nazi connections. Then we're going to take a look at connections between the Hinckley and Bush family. We're going to take a look at John W. Hinckley Sr.'s campaign support for George Bush's primary campaign when he was challenging President Reagan. We're also going to take a look at a proposed dinner meeting and business deal between Neil Bush, George Bush's son, and Scott Hinckley, the older brother of John W. Hinckley Jr. We're going to take a look at another connection between the Bush-Hinckley family, romantic relationship or social romantic relationship between Scott Hinckley and a friend of Neil Bush's wife. Then we're going to take a look at a number of articles indicating that World Vision, an organization that John W. Hinckley Sr. was active with, was in fact or has functioned as a CIA front in other parts of the world. We're then going to take a look at Edward Bennett Williams, a key attorney whose firm represented John W. Hinckley, Jr. Then we're going to take a look at how the Hinckley-Nazi connections evolved under the auspices, I should say, or under the legal counsel of the Edward Bennett Williams law firm. Then we're going to take a look at one of the many, many domestic Nazi connections to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a Texas Nazi of German extraction named Joachim Rudolf Rericht. We're going to take a break, then we're going to take a look at a possible assassination. I believe it was almost certainly an assassination, we'll never know for sure, but the certain death, and I feel probable assassination, of Willie Velasquez of San Antonio, Texas. We're going to take a look at certain aspects of that death, and I believe assassination, and we're going to speculate concerning its possible effects on the selection of Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas, a conservative Democrat, to be Michael Dukakis' running mate during the election or during the campaign this coming fall. We're going to begin by taking a look at the key role that the state of Texas is to play in the Democrats' southern strategy. Then we're going to take a look at an article from the San Francisco Chronicle this past week on Willie Velasquez and his impact on the American political scene in general, and in particular on the American political scene in the Southwest, where he was very active. We're going to take a look at the loss of Willie Velasquez and its possible effect on the Bush campaign. Willie Velasquez was cut down with a fast-acting case of cancer of the kidney at age 44, shortly after he had announced, well, he was originally supposed to live 6 months to a year, but Willie Velasquez made it less than a month, and he had vowed to go to work for Michael Dukakis in a key capacity during the time he had left. Of course, one of the things we've spoken about for a long time on this broadcast is not only political assassination per se, but the fact that the CIA, from 1954 on, had, as a matter of course, developed drugs which would give a human being cancer, thereby an assassination by cancer capacity belonged to the National Security Establishment from 1954 on. It's a safe bet that, given the advance in medical technology in general in the intervening period, the techniques for giving people cancer are probably much more sophisticated today. Then we're going to take a look at an interesting column by Tom Wicker in the New York Times this past week, comparing the Dukakis selection of Lloyd Benson with the John F. Kennedy selection of another Texas Senator, Lyndon B. Johnson, in 1960. Then we're going to take a look at the association. We're going to review a few of the aspects about Willie Velasquez's life and death. We're also going to take a look at the association between Willie Velasquez and San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros, who himself was the object of an ultra-right-wing plot this past spring. Fortunately, this one at least was abortive. We're going to conclude by taking a look at another assassination which affected a recent election, namely this is going to be very, very brief, but the assassination of Allard Lowenstein in 1980, which played a key role in shaping the results of the Democratic primary in 1980. Alrighty, now for the meat of tonight's broadcast. The first article comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Monday, July 11th of 1988. It's an AP story, Dateline Washington, headlined, Magazine says FBI memo shows Bush worked for CIA in early 60s. Vice President George Bush may have worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in 1963, more than a decade before becoming its director, according to a magazine article that cites an FBI memorandum. Bush denied the report through a spokesman. The Nation magazine, in its current issue, quotes an FBI memorandum dated November 29, 1963, from then-director J. Edgar Hoover to the State Department on the subject of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In the memo, according to the magazine, Hoover stated that the Bureau had briefed, quote, Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency, unquote, on the reaction of Cuban exiles in Miami to the assassination. The magazine article, quoted by Joseph McBride, also quoted an unidentified source, quote, with close connections to the intelligence community, unquote, as saying Bush started working for the agency in 1960 or 61 using his oil business as a cover for clandestine activities, unquote. Skipping down on the article, the magazine, that's The Nation, said Hoover's memo was recently discovered among 98,755 pages of FBI documents released in 1977 and 78 in connection with Freedom of Information Act suits. Hoover's memo relays concerns of an FBI informant in Miami that anti-Castro groups might capitalize on the confusion following the assassination to undertake an unauthorized raid against Cuba, the magazine said. The substance of the foregoing information was orally furnished to Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency, Hoover is quoted as saying. At the time, Bush was running at the Houston-based Zapata Offshore Oil Company, which the magazine said gave Bush an opportunity to do extensive overseas travel, including trips throughout the Caribbean. In 1964, Bush ran unsuccessfully for the Senate. In his 1987 autobiography, Looking Forward, unquote, Bush calls his appointment to head the CIA a real shocker, unquote, in light of his background as a non-professional outsider and a politician to boot, unquote. However, Bush also notes in his autobiography that, quote, I'd come to the CIA with some general knowledge of how it operated, unquote. The Nation article cites this line from Bush's book as a possible veiled reference to previous CIA experience. Well, we've talked at great length, of course, about the assassination of John F. Kennedy on this program. We've also spoken at great length about George Bush. We've never spoken about connections between the two before because we had never known of any, although we had spoken at great length about many of the similarities between the shooting of President Reagan and the assassination of President Kennedy in terms of some of the items involved, some of the same elements being involved. One of the things that we've talked about in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy is that we have described that particular event as the waste of an hourglass. Just about everybody who has come forward since that time of any real note seems to have connections, at least if not to the John Kennedy assassination, to one or another of this country's major political assassinations. Ronald Reagan, for example, helped to block Jim Garrison's investigation in 1966 by refusing to extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley to New Orleans. Edwin Meese helped handle the Edgar Eugene Bradley situation for then California Governor Ronald Reagan. George Bush, of course, if this memorandum can be believed, appears to have not only been working for the CIA, but specifically had been involved in the Gulf Coast region, which figures prominently in the assassination of John Kennedy, and may have been one of the liaisons to the anti-Castro Cuban community. As we looked at, not only in the Guns of November, but also in Radio Free America shows 11, 12, 13, and 15, the anti-Castro Cubans, among other elements of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, were involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The anti-Castro Cubans themselves were mostly used as street-level operatives, so to speak, helping to set up the various alibis and covers for some of the people who were to be acquitted ultimately and or convicted. It's interesting that George Bush has maintained, apparently, some of these connections to the anti-Castro Cubans. In Radio Free America show number 30, for example, as well as number 29, we took a look at George Bush's connections to the Carew group and to many of the wackle-related anti-Castro Cubans, figuring not only in the background of such events as the assassination of Orlando Letelier, but also in big-time drug trafficking as well. During the recent Iran-Contra scandal, those same elements came to light in a big way, including connections between such anti-Castro Cuban CIA veterans as Felix Rodriguez and George Bush. This particular article, if indeed the information upon which it's based is valid, raises, of course, the question of just how far back this particular milieu goes in terms of its cohesiveness. Theodore Shockley, of course, was the head of JM Wave, which in Miami handled all matters Cuban all over the world. That undoubtedly would have to have involved the assassination of John F. Kennedy, in as much as the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro umbrella group, shared a New Orleans address with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, an alleged pro-Castro group whose only member was Lee Harvey Oswald, who, as we have now learned from Freedom of Information Act documents, was not only a member of the CIA, but his CIA number was 110669, that from a declassified CIA memorandum obtained by the House Select Committee and brought to light by New York researcher Ted Gandolfo. So, again, for those skeptics who may find some of our statements concerning the Kennedy assassination and other assassinations as excessive, go study the record, and it really is, it's remarkable. One of the reasons I personally enjoy studying the assassination of John F. Kennedy, as unpleasant a subject as it is, it really is fascinating how many elements from the past coalesce in Dallas on 11-22-63, and how many of the elements that have come to prominence in a big way since that time were present there in a much smaller way. It really is a fascinating event. Now, of course, George Bush is running for president this year, and I thought it might be worth taking a look at his apparent connections to the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan in 1981, because some of the same elements that appear to have been central to the assassination of John Kennedy also crop up in connection with the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life. And I think it's worth taking a look at this in order to get some idea of the M.O. used by George Bush in his political forays. I recall, interestingly enough, too, that there are many, many connections between the assassination of John Kennedy and Watergate. George Bush was made Republican National Chairman during the Watergate cover-up period, and it was the period immediately following Richard Nixon's resignation. It's worth taking a look, again, I think, at our archive shows in order to flesh out your understanding of this. The Guns of November, about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the Aryan Nation series, Radio Free America shows 10 through 13, and Radio Free America number 15 all deal in a substantive way with the assassination of John Kennedy. Radio Free America shows 8 and 9 deal with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, respectively. Tonight, and for archival purposes, we're going to take a look at some of the information. Again, this is just some of the information concerning the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, this by way of assessing George Bush as a presidential candidate. Reading now from some of the articles that emerged in the popular press immediately after the shooting of President Reagan, which took place on March 30th of 1981. That was a Monday. Now, reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, March 31st of 1981, this is a story called John Hinckley, Profile of a Typical Guy. It's by Phil Bronstein of the Examiner, Dateline, Denver, Colorado. Up top, as if by way of a subhead, there's a quote from an American Nazi Party official. He wanted to shoot people and blow things up. We were not sufficiently militant for him. That quoting Nazi Party officials. Skipping down into the article and moving to the back page, this from page A14, San Francisco Examiner 331-81, we find the following. His, that's John Hinckley, his father, J.W. Jack Hinckley, president of a Denver oil exploration firm, remember the oil connection here, told Religious Associates some months ago that his son had long-standing psychological problems. The senior Hinckley told staff members of World Vision, a Southern California Christian group in which he was involved, that he felt, quote, great anxiety, unquote, over his son, who had, quote, problems for a long time, unquote. Remember the World Vision connection, we're coming back to it. An unidentified family friend told the Dallas Morning News, quote, John was simply what you would call their loner. They only talked about him in the way parents would when they hoped their individualist would come around and become one of the gang, unquote. Well, apparently he did indeed try to become one of the gang, witness the following paragraph. In Chicago, the president-elect of the National Socialist Party of America, Michael C. Allen, said Hinckley was expelled from the neo-Nazi party in November of 1979 because he, quote, wanted to shoot people and blow things up, unquote. The party official described Hinckley as a, quote, nut, unquote. He said they first met at a neo-Nazi march in St. Louis on March 12, 1978. A party leader said Hinckley left because, quote, he felt that we were not sufficiently militant for him, unquote. Harold Covington, president of the neo-Nazi group, said, quote, he wanted us to go out and commit unlawful acts. We sort of carried on a debate about it, unquote. Skipping down in the article. On October 9th, 1980, Hinckley was arrested trying to board a plane at the Nashville airport. He was carrying a .38 caliber revolver, two .22 caliber revolvers, and 50 rounds of ammunition. The guns were found as Hinckley's luggage passed through an X-ray scanner at a boarding checkpoint as Hinckley was preparing to board an American Airlines flight to New York. Hinckley was freed after he posted a $62.50 bond. The guns and ammunition were confiscated. And now as to what he may have been doing at the Nashville airport, regard the following paragraph. Former President Jimmy Carter was campaigning at Nashville's Grand Ole Opry that day, and 2 days earlier, Reagan had canceled a campaign stop in Memphis. The .22-caliber gun Hinckley allegedly used to shoot Reagan and three others yesterday was purchased at Rocky's Pawn Shop in Dallas on October 13th, according to the FBI. It is one of a string of pawn shops on the same street on which President John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. One wonders how deep some of these coincidences go. Hinckley, incidentally, was a native of Dallas, Texas. Witness the following paragraph. Hinckley is skipping down again in the same article. Hinckley was born in Ardmore, Oklahoma, on May 29th, 1955, according to hospital records. You know, I just realized that is John F. Kennedy's birthday as well. Also, incidentally, May Brussels. 2 years later, he moved with his family to a plush, two-story brick house with a swimming pool in the exclusive Dallas, Texas suburb of Highland Park. The family lived there until 1974, when it moved to Evergreen. That's Evergreen, Colorado. So, interestingly enough here, John Hinckley Sr.'s connections with World Vision are to be remembered. John Hinckley Sr.'s connections with the National Socialist Party of America are to be remembered here. The fact that members of that party suspected he was a federal agent should be remembered. And his curiously light treatment when he was hanging around the Nashville airport with all kinds of guns and ammunition, right about the time not only Jimmy Carter but Ronald Reagan were due in there. Interesting article here also in the same issue of the San Francisco Examiner. It's kind of ironic to evaluate this in light of that last information. How did he get so close? Agents want to find out. Dateline Washington Examiner News Services. How could it happen that in the nation's capital, a mile from the White House, a gunman stationed himself in the midst of a group of reporters and from 10 feet fired six shots at the President of the United States? Well, again, I think perhaps the following information, again repeating from the previous story. On October 9th, 1980, Hinckley was arrested while trying to board a plane at the Nashville airport. He was carrying a .38-caliber revolver, two .22-caliber revolvers, and 50 rounds of ammunition. The guns were found, etc., etc. So somebody apparently was willing to let Hinckley go with a little more than a slap on the wrist, despite the fact that he appeared to be a pretty dangerous fellow. If we can believe the Nazi Party officials, a little too extreme even for them. And remember, they suspected him of being a federal agent. More on the shooting of President Reagan. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of the following day, Wednesday, April 1st of 1981. This is from a story from page 1. It's called A Bizarre Motive for Shooting Reagan. It deals with the apparent cover story, which was floated to hide what I believe were the real political motives behind the Reagan shooting. Only occasionally, as in his conversations with the Lubbock maintenance man, were aspects of his life and his problems remembered. It was in Texas that Hinckley first met members of the National Socialist Party of America, who took him with them on an automobile journey in March of 78 to St. Louis, where he participated in an NSPA march to commemorate the birthday of George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party. "He seemed committed to our cause. He was bright, a little understated," said Michael C. Allen, acting director of the group recalling the St. Louis march. "He wore uniforms like the rest of us. He was a stormtrooper, black boots, the swastika, khakis, and the black helmet. But he was too militant. He wanted to destroy our enemies, blacks, Jews, and communists. It got to the point," said party stormtrooper John Gaynor, "that we suspected him of being a federal agent. He was just too far out. He wanted to destroy people." The Nazis themselves, I would say, of course, have also been known to want to destroy people, at least in the opinions of many here. But it's interesting that this particular Nazi group was one of the groups that goes directly back to George Lincoln Rockwell. Recall that George Lincoln Rockwell's Arlington, Virginia address and phone number were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest. Not that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. There is conclusive evidence that he didn't even fire a gun, let alone kill somebody. However, it's worth taking note of all of these pieces of evidence in order to determine the nature of the forces who were handling Oswald and creating the cover story, which has now come down to us in history, namely Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, shot President Kennedy, and then as to why pick one from column A and one from column B. He wanted publicity, he couldn't get enough sex, etc., etc., or, of course, he was a commie. He wasn't a commie, of course, we know now. He was a CIA agent. Of the connections between the Hinckley family and the Bush family, arguably the most important connections here, reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, April 1st of 1981. This is a UPI story, Dateline Houston, and headlined, "Suspect's Brother Knows Bush's Son." The brother of John W. Hinckley, Jr., the man accused of shooting President Reagan, was to have been a dinner guest last night at the home of Vice President George Bush's son, Neil, the Houston Post said in a copyright story yesterday. Neil Bush, who lives in Denver, said Monday his family knew the Hinckley family because they'd made large contributions to the vice president's primary campaign. He said he had once met Scott Hinckley but could not recall meeting his younger brother, who was accused of shooting Reagan and three other men Monday. Bush's wife, Sharon, said the dinner had been canceled. I would interrupt. I don't bet that it wasn't. Scott Hinckley is vice president of his father's Denver-based oil firm, Vanderbilt Energy Company. Again, repeating this, Scott Hinckley is vice president of his father's Denver-based oil firm, Vanderbilt Energy Corporation. He could not be reached for comment. Bush, who works as a land lawyer for Standard Oil Company of Indiana, said he could not recall meeting the subject. Sharon Bush said she did not know the subject. Quote, here quoting Sharon Bush, they, the Hinckleys, are a nice family and have given a lot of money to the Bush campaign, she said. I understand he, John Hinckley, was just the renegade brother in the family. They must feel awful. Well, it's interesting here that, according to this article, the Hinckley family were prominent backers of Vice President George Bush's primary campaign. And not only that, but they were apparent business and social contacts between them. Interesting here, too, that, of course, the Bushes were involved in independent oil companies on the Gulf Coast, Zapata Oil being the cover firm, apparently, if we can believe the article in the Nation magazine. And here, Vanderbilt Energy, another independent oil company, was the main business interest of the Hinckley family. And in fact, the Hinckley's Vanderbilt Energy was being investigated, or was the object of a proposed federal investigation at this time. And again, the proposed business deal here, and the dinner, which was to discuss possible business deal, is very, very interesting here. When one studies this country's political assassinations, it's remarkable how very quickly and easily one gets to connections to the obvious people that would benefit from a given political assassination. For example, the assassination of John Kennedy, we have Richard Nixon in Dallas on November 22, 1963, flying out right about the time Kennedy is getting killed and then lying about it to the FBI 2 months later. Lyndon Baines Johnson himself, LBJ, the vice president, had all kinds of obvious connections to the assassination itself, and I think it speaks extremely poorly for the political instincts and dedication of the American people that the type of research that myself and others in the field do continues to be dismissed as conspiracy theory. I think if people saw one of these assassinations done up as a plot on, say, Columbo or The Equalizer or some television crime melodrama, people would get bored and they'd probably turn it off after 10 minutes and get some ginger ale or something because they'd know that they'd know the ending of the plot. At any rate, again, although we cannot say for sure, certainly I think a possible motive here and a milieu which stood to benefit concretely from the death of Ronald Reagan is at least pointed to by some of the pieces of information in these stories. More on the connection between the Bush family and the Hinckley family. Of course, don't forget that George Bush was former director of the CIA, and had something happened to Ronald Reagan, George Bush would have become the most powerful man in the United States. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News from Wednesday, April 1st of 1981. This is another story continued from the front page, and it's skipping down in the story. Again, I don't have the front page with me here. But skipping down in the story, and on page 24A of the Mercury, 4181, we find the following at the top of the page, under the heading, Reagan Shooting Suspect Baird Plan in Love Letter. Vice President George Bush acknowledged Tuesday that his son, Neil, is a casual acquaintance of Hinckley's elder brother, Scott, 28. The two were to have dined together at Neil Bush's Denver home Tuesday evening. Scott Hinckley is dating a friend of Neil Bush's wife. So again, these two families are not strangers, and recall also, perhaps more significantly, that they are political allies. Recalling now John W. Hinckley Sr.'s connections with an organization called World Vision, we're now going to take a look at some information concerning World Vision. The following, actually research credit for the following articles goes to Sarah Diamond. This is from the National Catholic Reporter of April 23rd, 1982. It's by Adrienne Penick, P-E-N-N-I-N-K, and Steve Askin, A-S-K-I-N. It's headlined, Refugees Tell of Abuses at Hands of Agency. This is about World Vision and its apparent links, at least to a certain extent, to the CIA. The two Salvadorians arrived in Limones No. 2 refugee camp one evening last May. The camp coordinator reported their names to local authorities. The next day, Honduran soldiers demanded to see the refugees and took them away in a jeep. 2 days later, the refugees' lifeless bodies were found by the Lempa River, which forms the border between Honduras and El Salvador. According to World Vision, the Evangelical Protestant Relief and Mission Agency responsible for supervising the camp, the May incident was a horrible accident. To workers with other agencies serving refugees, both Protestant and Catholic, it was proof that their worst fears were justified, that World Vision was collaborating with Honduran and Salvadorian security forces against the refugees it was supposed to serve. Skipping down. Last year, several aid groups reported that they had stopped registering refugees with the government because they suspected names were being handed over to the death squads. World Vision continued to supply names. The behavior of World Vision staff members convinced many refugees that they were working with Honduran or Salvadorian security forces. Dozens of former residents of a World Vision-supervised camp in the Guarita region spoke of World Vision workers who appeared to be cooperating with security forces or who threatened reprisals against those who refused to convert. Members of one refugee family said World Vision workers told them, quote, "You will not receive food because you don't believe in our religion," unquote. Others told of World Vision workers who openly discussed their backgrounds in the Guatemalan secret police and Anastasio Somoza's Nicaraguan National Guard. The charges against World Vision were most starkly detailed in a memorandum prepared last June by the Honduran office of another international humanitarian group obtained through U.S. sources. Quote, "All the information I was given can be verified," the author wrote, "but it was agreed that to denounce World Vision locally would be dangerous not only for the refugees but for all the organizations working with them," unquote. The three-page memo was compiled from reports by several aid groups. Their names have been withheld to protect workers still in Honduras. Skipping down on the story, critics such as Father Earl Gallagher, U.S. priest who worked with refugees in the Guarita region, say World Vision workers repeatedly used food to pressure refugees to attend Protestant churches. Quote, "If they don't accept, they are warned that their food is going to be cut and that they will be handed over to the military authorities who in turn will hand them over to Salvadorian authorities, which means instant death," Gallagher said. "We have had many instances of that." He remembered an incident last June 26th when a World Vision representative visited a home near Guarita where 15 Salvadorians were living. According to Gallagher, the refugees were told, quote, "You accept this sect or I'm going to cut your food. If you don't, we are going to hand you over to the Salvadorians," unquote. Other refugee workers told similar stories but asked not to be identified by name. And again, following credit for the following story also goes to Sarah Diamond. This from Christian Century magazine, specifically Christian Century from July 4th through July 11th from 1979. This is an article called World Vision Go Home, or headlined World Vision Go Home. Skipping down into the story, it was during the Vietnam War that many of World Vision's inadequacies began to emerge. Instead of being a nonpartisan humanitarian operation, it expressed clear anti-communist sentiments and was openly supportive of American military participation. Indeed, at least 75% of its Cambodian operation was funded by USAID. American military trucks and helicopters were always available for World Vision programs, and the CIA used information obtained by the group's field workers as part of its normal intelligence function. As South Vietnam's government began to topple in 1975, World Vision became one of the many aid organizations to leave. In Laos, the new government was more tolerant of some of the aid programs, but the Minister of Religious Affairs was openly critical of missionary groups in both Vietnam and Laos, which had let themselves be used as agents for the CIA. He claimed that, quote, "The activities of World Vision, an American-based aid operation, had antagonized the people so much that there were popular demonstrations and the decision had to be made at cabinet level to have them expelled from the country." In the following years, World Vision tried hard to win credibility in several other Asian nations, but its ideological blind spots have created difficulties. So it appears that World Vision, at least in certain areas, has been used as a front organization by elements of the U.S. intelligence community and national security establishment. Again, that makes the John Hinckley Sr. connection to World Vision all the more interesting in light of not only the Hinckley connections to the George Bush primary campaign, the social and business connections, or burgeoning business connections, between the Hinckley and Bush family. Scott Hinckley and Neil Bush were going to discuss a possible business deal. It also makes George Bush's connections to the CIA, his possible connections in 1963, according to FBI reports, or his connections to the agency in 63, according to FBI reports, possible involvement in the aftermath of the assassination of John Kennedy, or perhaps the actual assassination of John Kennedy. And it also raises interesting questions concerning George Bush's tenure as CIA director. Interestingly enough, a prominent intelligence-linked attorney took the Hinckley case, or his law firm took the Hinckley case. Reading from the San Francisco Examiner from Wednesday, April 1st of 1981, in an article Begun on the front page, Hinckley's love letter to teenage movie star, we find the following story continued on page A12 of that issue. Hinckley, meanwhile, retained the firm of millionaire Washington defense attorney Edward Bennett Williams, a former treasurer of the Democratic National Committee and owner of the Baltimore Orioles baseball team. A member of the firm confirmed the two lawyers spent more than 2 hours yesterday interviewing Hinckley in the prison at the U.S. Marine Base at Quantico, Virginia. Well, Edward Bennett Williams is a very prominent attorney who's handled a lot of intelligence-related cases. He was the attorney for, among others, former CIA Director Richard Helms, and in his case, where he was convicted of lying to Congress. He also has represented Robert Vesco, a man with more connections than a switchboard. He has also represented, in the past, John Connolly. He has also represented Jimmy Hoffa and a whole host of other people. The law firm of Edward Bennett Williams has been close to all kinds of people in the intelligence community, very close to the Graham family of the Washington Post and others. In fact, they handled the execution of Philip Graham's estate. So the Hinckley law firm, or the Williams law firm being called in on this case is very, very significant here in my estimation. It's interesting, too, to see the kind of treatment that Hinckley's Nazi connections got after the Edward Bennett Williams law firm was engaged on their behalf. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, May 18th of 1982, more than a year later, the Nazi connections are receiving the following kind of play. This in an article by Stuart Taylor, Jr. of the New York Times, Dateline, Washington, skipping down. Hinckley, a white man who flirted with the American Nazi Party and imagined himself the leader of a racist, extreme right-wing political organization, is being tried before a black federal judge in a jury of 11 blacks and one white. But Hinckley's lawyers have not complained that his rights to a fair trial will be jeopardized by the racial makeup of the jury, and trial lawyers here say they do not believe either the prosecution or the defense will gain any particular advantage from it. Skipping down, Dr. William T. Carpenter, Jr., the first defense psychiatrist to testify as an expert witness, said that by 1979, Hinckley idolized Hitler and was writing elaborate manifestos, casting himself as head of an imaginary front, of an imaginary organization called the American Front, unquote, which would elevate, quote, white Protestants above blacks in the New York-Hollywood media axis of Jewish domination. Well, apparently Hinckley's Nazi connections were more than imaginary, whether he was, in fact, the head of his own organization or whether that was sort of a cover. Certainly, the right-wing Nazi and possibly intelligence connections of John Hinckley and his family did not receive the play they should have. And again, I think this by way of evaluating some of George Bush's background. It's also, again, very interesting that we see George Bush's name now cropping up in connection with the Kennedy assassination. The following excerpt was gleaned for us by one of our listeners. This is from volume 14, or volume 24, of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits. Concerns here an American Nazi of German extraction named Joachim Rudolf Rericht, and some interesting comments he made in and around the time of the assassination of John Kennedy. And I think, as George Bush assumes the Republican mantle in his race for Michael Dukakis, as we observe George Bush's possible connections to the assassination of John Kennedy, we should reflect upon the following information in this regard. Again, this is from Volume 24 of the 26 Volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits, page 529, about the connections of Joachim Rudolf Rericht not only to the American Nazi Party, but also, perhaps, to the assassination of John Kennedy. Recall that in Part 4 of The Guns of November, as well as in our Aryan Nation series in Radio Free America number 15, we went into the Nazi connections to the assassination of John Kennedy in considerable detail. On November 23rd, 1963, the Los Angeles Division furnished the following information. This, by the way, is a declassified. This is the FBI here. That's the Los Angeles Division of the FBI. On the evening of November 22nd, 1963, Mrs. Ernestine White of Fullerton, California, telephonically advised that a young German identified as Joachim Rudolf Rericht, R-O-E-H-R-I-C-H-T, an employee of Knott's Berry Farm, Buena Park, California, in a conversation with her on November 16, 1963, commented she would be surprised to know how many young men in Texas wore the swastika. He allegedly said that if the president came to Texas, he would be assassinated. He went on that in San Antonio, there are a number of young men who believe that Negroes should be killed. He allegedly said, quote, "We need a Goering to get rid of the Negro in the United States like they did the Jews in Germany." Barbara Wickware, an employee of Knott's Berry Farm, telephonically advised on the evening of November 22, 1963, that a German alien, identified as Rericht, employee at Knott's, went to Texas on vacation and returned approximately November 13, 1963. Upon his return, he told Ken Knott that if President Kennedy insists on continuing his trip to Texas, he will not come out alive. After hearing of the president's assassination, he laughed and stated that he knew all about it. So again, I think perhaps Joachim Rudolph Rarick's advice to Ernestine White in a conversation, again quoting from the FBI here, this is Commission Exhibit Number 2095, that's a Warren Commission. In a conversation with her, that is Joachim Rudolph Rarick talking to Ernestine White, in a conversation with her on November 16, 1963, subject commented she would be surprised to know how many young men in Texas wore the swastika. Again, I think a lot of people might be very surprised to know how many young men in Texas wear the swastika, both at the time of the Kennedy assassination and the time of the Reagan shooting and also now. Again, I think people should reflect carefully on the behind-the-scenes machinations of George Bush as they evaluate their decisions vis-a-vis voting this coming fall. It's worth noting, too, that one of our theses on this program has been that George Bush has really been in the driver's seat all along. In an article which appeared in the East Bay Express about a year and a half ago, an article about a former Reagan administration staffer named Roger Heffernan. This was authored by Paul Rauber, who works from time to time on KPFA. Heffernan stated in no uncertain terms that George Bush was the power behind the throne and that Reagan was nothing more than a figurehead. Heffernan himself was terrified of George Bush and what it was that Heffernan felt he planned to do. Again, I think perhaps one should reflect on whether or not Ronald Reagan, if he didn't, wasn't actually killed, and he obviously wasn't, may have gotten the message on March 30th, 1981, about just who was really in the driver's seat. We're going to take another very short musical break just to sort of punctuate the end of one particular section of the broadcast, and reflecting on the connections of George Bush, probably to the assassination of President Reagan, or the assassination attempt on President Reagan, quite possibly to the assassination of John Kennedy as well, certainly to the killing of Orlando Letelier. We are going to reflect now upon the recent death by cancer, of sudden cancer, 3.5-week kidney cancer, of a prominent Hispanic and Texas Democrat named Willie Velasquez. We're going to reflect on the recent selection by Michael Dukakis of conservative Texas Democratic Senator Lloyd Bentsen as his vice presidential candidate. And we're going to reflect on the possible relationship between the death of Velasquez and the ascension of Lloyd Bentsen. And we're going to compare this with the ascension of another conservative Democratic Texas senator to the vice presidency, namely Lyndon Baines Johnson. And we're going to all reflect on this against the background of George Bush's candidacy when we come back here on One Step Beyond.